Hello, everyone. This is Nicholas Katman with the FDA Group. Welcome to the Life Science Rundown. Before we jump into our discussion for today, just a little bit about the FDA Group. We help life science companies in the areas of quality assurance, regulatory affairs, clinical operations, commissioning, qualification, and validation, as well as CMC. We offer three different engagement models, which are consulting, staff augmentation, and full-time employee recruitment. So if you ever find yourself in need, just head over to thefdagroup.com to check us out and get in touch. So today I am speaking with Mukesh Kumar. How are you doing, Mukesh?
I'm doing very well, Nick. Thank you for inviting me here.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you for joining. So we're going to be talking about the challenges with setting up a GMP facility for a cell therapy startup. But before we get into the topic for today, could you introduce yourself, your background?
Sure. Thank you, Nick. And thank you, everybody listening. I am the CEO of FDA Map. We are a CRO, a small CRO in the Washington, D.C. area. And we help companies do everything they need to regarding FDA submissions, running clinical trials, interacting with FDA, and of course, doing compliance, compliance with GMP, compliance with GCP and others. I am a PhD by training in biochemistry. And I've been doing this, I've been consulting with companies for about 20 plus years, and always in the small scale industry space. So most of my clients are small and medium sized enterprises located worldwide. Bulk of our clients are in the US, but we also have a lot of non-US companies who come to us for advice and project management and related tasks.
Okay, great, thank you. So I know when we were preparing for the podcast, we were talking about some of the questions we were going to go over and kind of some of the clients that would be interested in this type of podcast. And mm-hmm. one of the segments that we were talking about is the startup segment. So, startups can come from academia, or they could, come up with something in cell therapy that they want to explore bringing to the market. And there's a lot of questions, especially for these people that are coming into this world for the first time. What are some of the questions that you receive from these individuals when they first approach you?
Well, you're right that many people, many companies in cell therapy space are startups. I mean, this till recently, this was primarily an academic exercise. Most of the cell therapy research in R&D, research and development of new therapies in cell therapy space have happened in academic centers, in top line academic centers worldwide. So, and only recently, the first few therapies were approved. The first cell therapy for CAR T was approved only 5 years ago. And since then, there have been a few, but most of them, if you look at the history, they were developed at academic centers and they got into clinical trials and finally got approved. So many of the companies who are developing cell therapy products are also companies that either recently came out of academia or are still affiliated with academic centers. You know, some large academic centers have product development initiatives, particularly for cell therapy. So most of the people who come to us have never done clinical trials, have never taken a product in human clinical, given it to people. They have done extensive work in animals and in cell culture, but they don't understand. And many times they have a lot of misperceptions about what's needed to launch a product in a clinical trial. Now, clinical trials, the most risky and the usually the most challenging clinical trial is the first clinical trial you do, because there is a lot of things you need to do to develop a product enough to use in a clinical trial, be compliant with FDA, and also be safe for people. And at the same time, being able to find the right dose, the right way of administering, having the right quality of product that it doesn't cause any harm to the patients in which you will test. So there are many questions that people have not thought of by that time. But they're very energetic. They're very enthusiastic about developing their products. So mostly the initial part is educating themselves about what's needed by the FDA. And then, depending on the kind of advice they get, people explore it differently. There's so many ways people explore it. I've seen people who have done way more than they needed to do for early stage clinical trials. And I've also seen people who, because of limitations of resources or knowledge, also have done not enough. And very rarely do you find the right combination where people have done just the appropriate amount of work to develop a product and use it in a clinical trial. So that first stage takes a lot of time for most of these companies. And then, once you do your first clinical trial successfully, everything becomes easier after that. If the product is good, you may find some good investors, you may find some good benefactors who may jump into and help you. And if it's not good, then usually you will give up and you will start something else. So once you do the first trial, things become very different. But the first trial is always the hardest to do, and there is not much help available. There are a lot of perceptions, some good, some bad in this industry, and companies deal with them on a case-by-case basis. So many of my people who come to me, my clients are people who are like that, who could be an academic center, could be a professor, could be an educationist, or could be a small startup that just started by licensing a technology from somewhere and they want to start their first trial. So that's, I would say, not only because of the nature of my business, but also that's what the industry is in this current stage.
And I would say for anybody that is anticipating that they're going to come into the world of FDA, my recommendation is to engage somebody that has significant experience in regulatory affairs sooner rather than later, because I've seen a lot of companies doing, to your earlier point, more than they needed to. And while there are benefits to some of the information they were able to get, some of it can't be used or could be a waste of time and money. So I think it's very important to engage a subject matter expert in that regulatory space sooner than later. The other thing that I would say is one of the things to be aware of for those people that are looking to get a subject matter expert in this space is there's a lot of people that can go and do the research and find out, what are the regulations and try to provide the guidance. If you hear, if you're interviewing somebody in the regulatory space and you hear them saying, well, I conducted research and I looked into it, that means they don't know what they're talking about, or they don't know enough where they had to go and do research. So look for those types of flags would be my recommendation. Definitely looking at somebody's CV and somebody that has a lot of experience in that particular space, because there's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of experience that can help accelerate you, can help allow you to avoid pitfalls, can allow you to save time and money. That's obviously going to benefit you in going down that pathway. So that would be one of my recommendations. Now, to your point, definitely lots of questions. First questions we get to is what is the pathway look like? What's the beginning? Mm-hmm. What does it look like toward the end? So that's a common question. One of the questions is, when should we engage the FDA? What are the first steps with the FDA? Mm-hmm. What do we need in order to start first in human clinical trials? Can you speak to that?
Sure. And I would add to, before I speak about, when to engage with FDA and what to do, I'll also add to a little bit to what you mentioned earlier about engaging an expert. I actually tell people to take one extra step to also educate themselves a little bit about what's needed, because, experts come in all sizes and shapes, as you know, and, it also depends on what their experiences have been and what their exposure has been. But cell therapies are very unique. Every cell therapy is different. So we have not reached the stage where we can focus on the commonalities and not ignore the differences, because in pharmaceuticals, for example, over the last 50 years, we have we have started focusing on the commonalities, because there's so much common across all kinds of products that the individual differences don't make that much of a difference. Cell therapy is not there yet. Cell therapy is still in its infancy to a large extent. So it's very important to educate yourselves about what's available. There's a lot of information available. You know, we live in an age where you Google something and you'll find thousands of pieces of information about it, both good and bad. So I tell people, because when people come to us and they don't know even the basics, it becomes hard for them to grasp what we are saying. They can't appreciate the importance of what we are saying many times, and they're second guessing us. And usually that leads to more problems, because you tell them something and the person doesn't know if what I'm saying to them is okay or not okay. And they're scientists. They're not, these people are smart people. So many a time they have opinions about what's risky, what's not risky, what's important, what's not important. So for them, it's important to understand the difference between what's important for academic research or their research so far versus what's important for an IND or to support an FDA discussion. So you know, it's important to educate themselves about it.
That's actually a really good point. And I do want to put the question I asked you on the shelf, because I do want to actually add on to that. That's a really good point that you should do some research, because as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, the internet, it's got a lot of information, some good, some bad. There's also AI. AI can produce information that can be good. It also can be bad. However, so how do we determine if information is good or bad? Well, if you get 9 sources out of 10 that all say X as opposed to Y, the probability that X is true is more likely than Y is true. So to your point, if you go and educate yourself and you find out that X is the case, and then you speak to a subject matter expert and they say X is the case, doesn't mean X is the case, but it does mean that the probability that X is the case is higher. So that's a very good point.
So typically due diligence, people would come to us to verify what they have heard. And I say, so we meet both kinds of people. We meet people who have never thought about it and come to us, and we have to educate them a lot about what the rules are, what's expected. And it's usually harder for them, mostly for them. We have a job. We know what to do. We will deal with it. But many times people face a little bit of a hurdle to fully grasp. And we also have a lot of people who have done their due diligence, done their research, and they come to us to verify and to confirm what they're doing and to execute. You know, just because you read a lot doesn't mean you're able to do it. You still need help. But you are able to get appropriate help, and you're able to execute it. You're able to ask the right questions. You know, many times there was an old saying, an educated customer is a good customer, you know. So, you know, that applies in our profession as well. And I see a lot of times that people who have done a little bit of research, they understand where we are coming from. So they appreciate what we're asking them to do. So, and that brings me to the question that you asked about when to interact with FDA and what should you do. And that's a very important question, because doing a meeting with FDA, you know, is a lot of resource intensive exercise. Whether you hire consultants or whether you do it yourself, it takes a lot of time to do that. And actually, FDA meetings are very risky events, in my opinion, because you may get an opinion that you're not able to execute, and you got an opinion because you didn't ask the right questions. So it's very important to interact with FDA at a stage when you can get the most benefit. So in terms of when should you interact, that's a decision you should make by discussion internally and with your consultants what the right time is. Because many times people jump the gun, people go very early on, and they get very high level, very generic advice from FDA. And then they live by that advice for their development, and those are people who end up doing more than they need to do most of the time, because regulators will cite you guidance documents, they'll cite you very generic advice, they will cite you, because they may be talking to large companies and small companies, they're talking to all of them, so they may be seeing companies who are doing a lot, and they may tell you, oh, I expect to see all of that. Well, yes, I also expect to do all of that, but I don't have the resources, I don't have tens of millions of dollars to do all that work that they're doing. I'm a small company doing its first trial in 10 patients. So do I need to do all of those things? Can I do something? That's where regulators will not tell you. Mm. Regulators are in that place. Regulators will only tell you if what you're proposing to them is acceptable or not. They will never tell you, you don't need to do that. You can do this instead. Very rarely regulators will say that. if you don't ask them the right questions, you'll get the wrong, or you'll not get the right answers.
Yeah.
So I think in terms of going to FDA and asking, that's very subjective. I've seen companies where we advise them to go early because what they were doing is so different that nobody has done it. And the technology is not very well understood. The way they're growing cells, like I'll give you an example. We were talking to a company developing CAR T therapy. And CAR T therapy, there are several ways to transpose the genes in the cells. And the way people normally do is using lentiviral vectors or using some kind of retroviral vectors to transpose their cells. And a risk with that, the way of making cells is because the genetic elements integrate in the genome, you can potentially activate oncogenes. You could have, and there is a concern, actually, just recently CAR T therapies were stopped because there was a higher than normal incidence of certain leukemias in those patients. So that was in the news just last month. And many clinical trials in that were asked by FDA to go and do extra research to find out what the cause is and all that. So, but there are already 8 therapies approved by FDA. So of course, those therapies are still going to be available and used. But the new therapies that are in development, they are suddenly have to do new things. Now, in CAR T, there's a new mechanism to transpose cells, which use transposons. And that mechanism does not integrate. It does the same thing, but gives you same benefit, but lower risk. So we had companies come to us who wanted to use the new technology, but that technology has never been used in any clinical trials. That has never been used by FDA. So our advice was to check with FDA to make sure that FDA would sign up on this before you invest in doing all the other things you need to do. So there, an early stage meeting is more productive. And then we had companies who are developing traditional CAR T therapies or traditional gene therapies, where there are already approved products are there. There's a lot of knowledge available. So in those cases, we advise them that why don't you develop the product fully and go to FDA for talking about the protocol design. Don't go for GMP. We have examples. We can help you. But for the protocol design, that's where you may want to go to FDA to see what kind of clinical trial should I do. So a more later meeting, not right away. But that advice we could give because we have seen that. And many times people don't appreciate that because as professionals, we it's our job to keep an eye on the news. We look at anything that happens at FDA in the industry. We look at news releases. We look at guidance documents. We look at presentations. We go to conferences. So we hear what people are doing. So we have a perspective which is more holistic, which is more broad than average person would have. That's the only reason we are called subject matter experts, because we know a lot about it. So it's important to talk to a subject matter expert and get the right advice, because I also see people who get scared. They will read a news about something happening with CAR T therapy, and I had people coming to me saying, oh, you know, my investors are telling me we should probably not do it. It's too risky. You know, we may get sued. And I told them that's not the, probably you are getting more scared than you need to. You should be aware about it, but not give up on it. So that's the advice that we can give, that people would not probably, and sometimes even if their investor was telling them don't do it, but they wanted to do it and their scientists were telling the risk was low. So we become kind of a mediators. We play a role of helping them come to the right discussion. Maybe I'll talk to the investors and explain to them why I believe it's not something that you should abandon, but yes, you should pay attention to it. So those are the kind of discussions that determine when you should talk to FDA, when you should engage. I would say engaging with subject matter expert as early as possible is always a good idea. And because there are certain things that you may find it may take you years to find that information that we have already there. So time is very precious. You know, if you believe that your product should be, and I believe strongly that any therapeutic product should get to patients as quickly as possible, because someone somewhere is going to benefit from this therapy if it's available. And by delaying it in time, we are delaying therapy to get to a patient. I look at it as our responsibility as developers, as humans, to get a medicine to a patient who needs it as quickly as you can. And you're not doing that if you spend 3 years thinking about something. You know, I think you're not doing anybody a good service if you waste time. And I look at it as wasted time if you could have done something 6 months ago that you're doing now, just because you didn't have the right advice. So I tell people that the most precious commodity that you cannot buy is time. You can buy everything else. You can do everything else. But time, when you lose time, that's gone. You can't get it back. So you should always look at it from time point of view, because everything related, cost is related to time. If you're spending 3 years on something, you're spending 3 years worth of time, and your time is worth something. Don't think your time is worth zero. People sometimes think, I'm doing myself, so it's free. Well, it's not free, because you would have made money, you would have made a salary, you done the job somewhere, and that job would have been important for you. So just by not doing that, you're losing money. So you are spending money. You're not, it's not free. Nothing is free. So evaluate that and talk to FDA depending on the right time. The first thing you should do is get enough information, enough knowledge about it. Then you talk to subject matter experts to confirm what you're doing and strategize what you want to tell the regulators or anybody else. And then go and confirm that with regulators before you invest millions of dollars and years of time developing something that you may or may not need.
Yeah.
Always confirm with the regulators. And then, you know, then everything becomes easy, because you've already taken three steps before you got to manufacturing. You're much more smarter than you were. You have much better information. And you're going to be much more successful. Your chances of success are much higher because you've done it properly. If you start cutting corners on any of these steps, education, subject matter expert, and FDA, if you don't go it that way, you're going to end up spending more time and resources and taking a higher than normal risk to do the thing that you could have done better.
Yeah.
Now, I look at it as, you know, that's the goal. Everybody wants to do it better. We want to do better than our competition. We want to be faster to patients. We want to get approved before everybody else. So if that's your goal, which it should be, then this pathway I'm talking to you is important.
Yeah. And you know, to engage subject matter experts in the regulatory affairs space early on is a relatively low cost. Mm-hmm. They're not doing a lot of writing. It's a lot of, in the beginning, just conversation about, you know, so it really is a very minimal investment in terms of what you're going to get out of it and all the time and money that you can save. So that's a really good point. And as you were talking, a couple other things kind of jumped out at me. You were talking about the risk. And I think one of the things that's been another benefit is understanding what is the level of risk, right? So there, you know, a couple different types of risk. What's the likelihood that you're going to fall into that situation, and how severe is it, right? And so being able to put risk in the correct perspective, I think, is very important. And that's what a really good subject matter expert can provide. And also, how can you mitigate those risks is another piece of advice that can be brought. And then the other thing I wanted to talk about or complement with what you said was, when talking to FDA, they're a regulatory authority, and talking to the FDA is like talking to the police, talking to the IRS, talking to a judge. If you don't speak to them correctly, you can get yourself in some hot water, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's very, very important that you have counsel that understands the correct terminology to use, mm-hmm. the correct way to phrase questions, the chronology of questions. Otherwise, if you're opening it up to allow them to say, yeah, I want all the information, they'll take all the information, and it's all documented. And if that's what they're adjudicating in the meeting, then, you know, that's what they expect to see. So it's very important that you have somebody counseling you so that you can optimize the outcome of that meeting, so that you can actually get your trials done in a timely and costly manner.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep. Okay. So let's assume we've engaged with a startup. We've counseled them. We've talked about, we've got to, you know, go and speak to the FDA about mm-hmm. first in human clinical trials. You know, what other questions do you think the audience listening is going to want to know? Some of the things that are popping into my mind are, how long does it take? What is the cost? What is the process? Enlighten us.
So it's a loaded question. There are too many things in there. But I think one thing that I have learned by doing it many times is that the cost and time are, many people get surprised, is not as high as they may have assumed based on the online searches they did or what the competition told them. You can use a lot of resources readily available to you. If you have done R&D, if you've done some experiments in animals with your product or in culture, in cell culture, many of those resources can be reassigned to do your first clinical trial manufacturing as well. Much of the talent, much of the skills that you've developed doing those experiments can be harnessed to support your clinical trial product as well. So it's not as expensive. There is a guidance that FDA wrote almost 15 years ago on first-in-human clinical trial, GMP for first-in-human clinical trial. It was, I think, written in 2006, 2005, many years ago. And that guidance applies very, very much to cell therapies as well. It talks about when you're doing a first-in-human study, what is the threshold of risk that you are allowed to take? You know, with a small number of people at a risky for a risky disease, what are the risks? Risk is not a single dimension entity. Risk is a multidimensional entity. There are many things that affect the level of risk that you're willing to take for a product. So it is proportion. It is directly proportional to inversely proportional to the disease you're targeting. So if you're targeting a disease at a high risk, you're able to take more risk with your products. Your threshold for risk is little higher. You have to be really bad to not try it in a disease that kills people, and vice versa. But you know, in terms of the time it takes, based on my experience, when people use their own resources and try to upgrade their current facilities to make them into first clinical product manufacturing, the cost is very, very small. Mostly the cost is in terms of documentation and quality systems that you need to set up. Many R&D labs do not have, for example, a quality system. They don't have SOPs, they don't have org charts, they don't have proper training. They don't have a due diligence process for vendor selection or selecting of their supplies and reagents and other things like that. So many of them, they don't do. They're using research grade material, for example, for many of the experiments. So those are things that they need to upgrade their facilities, which takes time, you know, but not as much time as going to a CMO and getting them to manufacture something, doing a process transfer. Process transfer could take you 6 months, you know, and in 6 months you could have set up your own facilities with all the bells and whistles. So it takes less time than going to a CMO. It also costs a lot less. I mean, if you look at the cost, again, I'm talking of direct costs. I'm not talking of the time you spend and your time and what's your time worth. I'm not talking about it. I'm talking about the checks you will need to sign. You'll be signing smaller checks if you're doing it in-house. And again, it will depend on what you have in-house. If you don't have anything in-house and you have to start buying stuff, then yes, it may end up costing money. Like, for example, a very common question comes up is, do we need to set up a clean room or can we do it in a hood, in a biosafety cabinet?
Mm-hmm.
According to FDA, a biosafety cabinet is as good as a clean room. You can spend $2 million buying a clean room. You know, a clean room, setting up a clean room with certain standards, ISO 5, ISO 7, ISO 6 clean room, could cost you easily $1 million to $2 million. And I'm talking of you're buying a modular clean room. If you buy a modular clean room, the minimum you're looking at is the list price. That's just the purchase price is about $500,000. And then, you know, use on top of it, the space where you put it in, you have to set up the space for this to keep the module. And then you have to set up other things around it that will end up costing you $1 million plus. By the time you're finished, it'll be costing you that much. So do you need to do that? A hood, on the other hand, costs $15,000, $10,000. So it's 1/10, or sometimes if you're talking $1 million, it's less than 0.1%, 0.1% to buy a hood. So, and that's acceptable. They're both acceptable. If you go to FDA and say, should I set up a clean room? FDA will say, yeah, sure. But if you tell them, is my hood good enough? And they'll say, yeah, that's also good. So that's where expertise comes into play. That's where those are the places. See, a good advice will pay for itself.
Mm.
You know, if you go to a good doctor, if you go to a good lawyer, they'll pay for themselves. You go to a bad doctor, you go to a bad lawyer, you could end up losing the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you go to a good construction person, you go to a good company, they'll build you a good house, a house that you can live for 50 years. You cut corners, you do it yourself, you do something, your house may collapse in 10 years. You may not get the same, you may not get the same quality appliances. A good appliance will last longer. It may cost you more, but you know, you'll use that oven for a long time. So these are things that we do in our life. We know these things. You buy a good car, it will last you a longer time. You buy a cheap car, it will break down sooner. So, you know, in life, in everything, those concepts are universal. Those are not just meant for our industry. So I tell people the cost, you said cost, how much the cost? I've set up GMP facilities in less than $100,000. And I've set up GMP facilities in millions of dollars. You know, so it all depends on what my client is looking at. I have companies who come to us saying, we have raised $10 million for a GMP facilities. Absolutely, you can spend that kind of money. And I have companies who come to us, I don't have money, I'm writing a grant, I got some money from some investors. What's the minimum I can do to still do my clinical trial? And we have set up last facility we set up for a CAR-T facility was $100,000. I mean, give or take a few. I mean, it wasn't a lot, maybe 120. It wasn't in millions of dollars. And it took them about 3 months to set it up. Okay. It cannot take 3 months to set up even a CMO. Your contract negotiation will take longer than 3 months. Okay. So that's where time and expense becomes a loaded question, because, you know, I cannot generalize it. I have to look at your specific situation and look at what you have. But I can guarantee you that if you go out and get quotes for this product from CMOs, from other people, and come to me, I can easily cut that down to at least 70% by coming it in-house. So, and I'm telling you from experience, having done it many, many, many times, I'm generalizing it, but it could be more than that also. It may be 50%. It may be, but it will always be less. It will never be same.
Yeah.
It will never be more. So that's where, you know, a time and cost become subjective to what people are coming to you for. If somebody says that my investor only wants to use this big CMO, well, then in that case, you have to go through a process, transfer and contracts and all those things. That's your calling. But if somebody tells me different wise, then we can find solutions. That's where subject matter expertise becomes critical for a project like this. These are very expensive, long-term, high-impact projects. You cannot do surgery on yourself. So you should not be manufacturing your products yourself without getting the right advice.
Yeah.
It's like literally somebody doing surgery on themselves. A good surgeon would also go to somebody else to get their own treatment. They would not write prescriptions for themselves. They will actually go to a doctor and talk to them. A good lawyer will hire another doctor to fight a case for them. They will not fight their own case, because there's so many things that happen when you do yourself. You know, there's a conflict of interest. There's the emotional attachment that doesn't allow you to make good decisions. There are a lot of other things that come into play when you're doing your own thing. So it's always good to get an independent advice.
So let me ask you a question. So if somebody were trying to consider, should I go to a CMO for my clinical supplies or should I do it in-house? Generally speaking, what would be your recommendation? Because it seems like your recommendation is leaning toward doing it in-house. Is that correct?
For first in human, I would always recommend to try it in-house, because first in human is the riskiest part of a program. You are doing a small trial in 10 people, 15 people, to see if what we saw in animal studies or in culture even means anything. Okay. You want to spend all your resources to get that drug to that patient. And anywhere you can reduce cost. So for first in human, I strongly advise not to. And I have nothing against CMOs. I have some very good friends who have CMOs and I like them and I work with them. But in the beginning, if you have only $1 million, you don't want to spend that million in setting up manufacturing and have no money to do your trial. I would rather you have some money left for your trial to file your IND, to do your protocol development, to find the investigators, pay the doctors to do your trial. That's going to cost you too. So if I have to choose where I want to spend my money, I want to spend my money to get this product into a patient. And to get my product into a patient, what is the minimum I need? Even FDA tells you least burdensome approach. FDA said least burdensome approach for 20 years. FDA has been saying the top of the mountain, use the least burdensome approach. And the least burdensome approach, even FDA wrote guidance document on it. That, you know, the thing I told you, a hood is as good as a clean room. That's quoted from the FDA guidance document, you know, or saying using single-use material is better than using reusable material that you use to autoclave is low risk. That's a quote, direct quote from the guidance document. They said, you know, don't buy something that you do autoclave, because you don't buy the autoclave and do it. Buy single-use supplies and do your first in-human study, because buying an autoclave is an investment, and also it costs money, and to maintain it and to certify it, all those things will cost money. While you can get away with buying a single-use product, single-use reagents, single-use supplies. So these are quotes from the guidance document. The problem is that's where, you know, because we have read it from the day the guidance was written and we have applied it, we can tell you what are the things available to you. Certain things you will have to use, you know, certain facilities, certain kind of products will need it. And we can help you make that decision if that's needed or not needed. So again, when we talk about cost and time, you need to look at it from a very, very pragmatic way. What is needed really? What is good to have? And what can be deferred to a later time?
Okay.
Those are three things. There are only three ways any information can be used. It needs to be done today. It can be deferred to a later time, or we don't even need it.
Right. Next question. So if you're recommending that it be done in-house for first-in-human clinical trials, is there a point at which you think it makes a shift where you think, okay, once you hit this point in time, you would recommend that you transition to a CMO?
The moment you start thinking of commercial product launch, the moment you get into the next phase 2B or a phase 3 study or a pivotal study or a registration study, there you need to go to either set up your own manufacturing to higher level of GMP or go to a CMO, because there the threshold is very high. The guidance for first in human also says the moment you get into phase 3 and phase 2B and all, you should go to full GMP. You cannot do partial GMP. So if you do a first trial and it goes really, really well, FDA tells you, I'm going to give you RMAT, I'm going to give you breakthrough, I'm going to give you a faster accelerated pathway. The moment you get into that, you need to start thinking about full GMP. Whether you do yourself or you set up, you go to a CMO, that discussion should be had at that time. Many companies set up their own manufacturing for intellectual property reasons and also for complexity reasons. It's too complex for a CMO to do. So we do it in-house. Or we have intellectual property that we don't want to give to external party. We have to protect this trade secret. So they will set up their own manufacturing. But then you go to full GMP. You have to probably buy a modular clean room at that time. You probably do some other things at that stage. But before that, you can do less and get more.
Okay, excellent. Well, I think this was a lot of really good information for people that are, you know, at this point, they're startups, they've got cell therapies, and, you know, this came across their newsfeed and they said, hey, let me click on this. Let me just hear some advice. Hopefully they were able to get some nuggets out of this. Before we wrap up, what would you like to leave the audience with?
Well, I would say if you have a product in non-clinical stage or cell culture stage or animal stage, I urge you to take it to humans, take it to clinical trial, because we need therapies. We need these therapies. And I've spent my life to developing new drugs, and I strongly support and believe and want to do everything I can to help patients. I think in the end, you know, we are in healthcare, we are in therapy space, so we want to help patients. And there are a lot of treatments that are new that people don't have access to. They were not developed. Some of these therapies have been developing for, like, I did my PhD in cell therapy. So that was 20 plus years ago. So I think from a logical and practical, emotional, financial, in all those ways, we need more therapies to get to patients. So if you have an idea that you think can treat somebody, don't sit on it. Take it to clinical trials. And let us know, and we will be there to be with you side by side to make it possible, to make it feasible, to make it work for you. So I'll stop with that.
Okay, awesome. Well, Mukesh, this was really awesome. Great insight. Really appreciate the time. And for everybody listening, as always, if you find conversations like this valuable, please share it with a colleague or your professional network. If you haven't already, subscribe to get updates of new episodes at thefdagroup.com/podcast and follow the FDA Group on LinkedIn. If you'd like to connect about project or resource needs, head over to thefdagroup.com to get in touch, or feel free to connect with me personally on LinkedIn. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we'll see y'all next time.